In the last lecture, I left you with a little puzzle. Well, perhaps I left you with several puzzles. But the puzzle that I was thinking about is I started off by introducing this idea of satisfaction, protocols, and the idea that one class can satisfy another class's protocol. And I used that as the basis for inheritance. I said, that's what inheritance is. When you talk about inheritance, that is what you're talking about. And then I pointed out that that was a minimalist point of view with respect to what most people think inheritance is. And then we went on to talk about what what Java thinks inheritance is, and it's all this other stuff. In particular, it's this idea of not only the relationship between the signatures of the parent and the child class, but also the code. What happens to the code. And that's the more typical meaning of what inheritance is. You know, the parent has some method, and the child inherits from the parent, which means that the child also has this method. And that starts to introduce various complications, like what happens when the child overrides the method that it inherited from the parent. What does it mean to override that method? When does that method actually get overridden? That's one of the reasons I like this simplified point of view with respect to inheritance. Just thinking in terms of signatures and whether or not one class satisfies another class's protocol. But that leads to the puzzle. What good is that? What's the point? Why is that such a hot deal? I mean, you can't even share code. So why would you even think about using inheritance like that? Why is that a useful idea? That's the topic of today's lecture. That's what I'd like to talk about today, is why is this notion of protocols and protocol satisfaction such a useful idea? Why did I dignify that with the name of inheritance, when in fact inheritance, generally speaking, involves so much more? I decided that our friend Plato belongs in the discussion on polymorphism, not only because, of course, polymorphism has its basis in Greece as opposed to inheritance, which sounds like a Latinish language, but also the idea underlying the notion of the Platonic ideal is more in tune with the idea of polymorphism than inheritance. I moved Plato from inheritance to polymorphism. We'll be talking a little bit about polymorphism. We'll be talking more about it with respect to interfaces next week. Then we'll look at some mechanisms a mechanism that's provided to allow this definition of protocols that other classes can satisfy in a way that doesn't involve as much work as taking one class and creating a protocol, and that's the notion of an abstract class. And then we'll actually talk about polymorphism. What is this thing I'm talking about, polymorphism? We will look at the polymorphism that Java gives you, which is an extremely weak form of polymorphism. I'll talk a little bit about the three kinds, or at least the three ways that you can provide polymorphism in languages. And they are exemplified by the way that Java does it, the way that C++ does it, and the way that C# does it. And of the three of those, Java's is the weakest, which is the one, of course, we have to work with. And it's related to this notion of object being the Ur class, the Ur parent. Bless you. So if you think about what it takes to define a protocol, you need to have a bunch of methods, and methods will have bodies and all these other things. So if you actually want to use inheritance in the way that I've been advocating in terms of protocol satisfaction, you have to do a lot of other things that you really don't need to do. You have to declare methods with bodies, and you have to figure out all these things. Now, with respect to regular inheritance, that makes perfect sense, right? You just sit there and you go, well, yeah, because, you know, the child gets to inherit the methods from the parent. But my argument is you really don't want to think about things that way. That's a bad way to think about things. So with respect to this idea of satisfaction and protocols, defining classes to give you protocols is overkill. You have to do too much work. And in particular, by just concentrating on the syntax, and remember, this I said was sort of one of the great lies in inheritance, this fact that, whoa, you know, we're talking about behaviors, and, oh, the parent behaves like the child, and the child behaves like the parent. But in fact, what that all reduces to is syntactic checking. You need to make sure that the Actually, you don't even need to make sure of this because you can make mistakes in, for example, getting the signatures wrong. And the textbook has an example of this, where you mistype the signature of the parent method that you want to override, and you end up not overriding that signature. I think it was with respect to the equals. We'll talk about it later on today. With respect to the equals operation that you inherit from parent. And that's what the at overrides annotation is. It signifies that, you know, well, I'm writing this as a override for some parent or ancestor class, and if that's not the case, let me know, because that's my expectation. I talk about it in the lecture. But you have to do a lot of things that you really shouldn't have to do if you're interested in pursuing this notion of satisfying protocols. What we want to do is something like this. We want to define a dictionary that gives me a protocol for these data structures that you can store information in and retrieve information from. Any class that satisfies this protocol, any class that satisfies this protocol, you would like to believe, and again, this is the great lie, you would like to believe will behave like a dictionary. Now, of course, you can do arbitrary things in here. You can delete files and send bomb threats to the White House and, you know, do all kinds of things in each one of these. So there's no guarantee that these methods, when you call them, will actually do what they're supposed to do. I indicated that's probably one of the most significant areas of research in object-oriented programming today, is to move that along so that, in fact, you can say, yes, when you call add, you can anticipate that this value will be in the data structure under this key, and guarantee that's the case. If that's not the case, if your implementation doesn't do that, then your inheritance fails. But that's way far. We're not even close to being able to do that. So we're still left with a wing and a prayer, as they say. But this is what we'd like to do, but this is what we can't do. Well, it turns out, in fact, we can do it. At least in, I see I'm running out of, let's see if we can make it smaller here. Do I need to do this? Yes, we can. I guess the answer is you can. What we'd like to do is we'd just like to be able to say, here is the syntax of the method that you have to match in the protocol. And you can do that with what's known as an abstract method. Needlessly implementing protocol class methods can be a pain. On the other hand, there can also be some form of documentation, since they give you an expectation of what this particular method should do when you call it. When I call this method, then this value will appear in the data structure under this key. It will not launch the missiles. That's not a hard thing to do, right? I mean, you can do this. But it can be confusing, because now the person reading your code is saying, is this complete? Is this person actually, am I looking at something I shouldn't be looking at? Or is this what this person actually meant? This, of course, notice that this tells you nothing about what the method should actually do. Notice also this is wrong, because, for example, in the case of, I guess it was find, I had a value returning method. This is a non-value returning method, but this is a value returning method, so I can't do this. This is syntactically wrong. I'll get an error message from the compiler saying, where's the return value? We can rely on the Java feature known as abstract methods to eliminate this unbearable strain or unbearable burden that's placed on us by having to do things like this and introduce ambiguity in terms of what the person who wrote this thing actually meant. The point here being, an abstract method has no implementation, so it's legitimate to say nothing here. You're explicitly communicating the fact that this is the form of what you have to do, and it's your responsibility as a child or descendant to fill in the rest. Notice that you're giving the descendant no help here. They have no idea how this is supposed to behave. Maybe you are supposed to launch missiles at this point. We introduce an abstract method with the keyword abstract. So here's another keyword on our method declarations. And by adding abstract to the signature, we get to eliminate the body. So that unbearable burden has been lifted from our shoulders. We're no longer under that intense strain of typing the curly brackets and making sure they match. Oh, what a pain. That introduces a problem. You see, this is the thing. You have a particular problem, so you introduce a new feature to solve it, and now you've got combinatorics. Now you've got all these things that you have to think about in terms of the interaction of your new feature with everything else. So we now have the ability to declare tag a method as being abstract, which means you don't have to implement the body. There's no body here. But now the question is, what happens if I put that method in a class and I want to instantiate the class? What do I do about that? And what's the problem there? Why is this such a difficult thing? Why is this something that would cause us to hiccup? Or maybe it shouldn't. I don't know. Maybe I'm just being a worrywart.
We have these functions that don't actually do anything.
Right. So... It's even worse than they don't do anything. Right. They don't even exist. They don't have a definition. And the problem then would be, what happens if I have those three, in the example here, I guess, what happens if I have my class with these three abstract methods in my dictionary, and then I create a dictionary, and then call find on hello. What should that do? That doesn't really make any sense. Now, we can't carry that argument too far, because it does, in fact, make sense to have variables of protocol class type. Okay. Now, what distinction am I drawing here between the types of variables? So I've just said something, and in terms of what we talked about on Tuesday, what did I say? Here I'm saying it doesn't make any sense to have an instantiation of a class that contains abstract methods, but it does make sense to have variables of that type. With respect to what we talked about on Tuesday, what am I saying?
You have to have a dynamic type that actually that isn't abstract.
You have to, right, so say that.
Like, it's okay for the static type to be an abstract class, but it's not okay for the dynamic.
Exactly. What we're saying here, another way to say what we're saying here is that having a dynamic type be abstract is a problem, because that raises the issue of what do we do about this. Having a static type be abstract is not a problem, because we don't actually do anything on the static type. It's the dynamic type that we're interested in. So that's exactly the way to say that. And, of course, the reason that makes sense, the reason that we can say static types are okay, is because we can rely on the is-a-type compatibility. If I have some descendant of dictionary, then the descendant of dictionary is a dictionary, and therefore I can assign a reference of that dynamic type to the dictionary of, sorry, to a variable of that static type. That's fine, because that is an acceptable... those are compatible types. That's an acceptable assignment. This is another indication of what we're talking about with respect to polymorphism. Notice that this holds on any descendant of dictionary. So this gives you an indication of the kind of advantage you get by just thinking about the notion of the protocol satisfiability. This is a pure redundancy. I think even the book Cornell and Horstman point this out. If I have a class with abstract methods, then that's a special class in the sense that I shouldn't be allowed to instantiate it. Oh, and you might want to pay attention, because I'll give you a little secret. We are actually going to instantiate abstract classes later on in the semester. So I'm telling you something that, in fact, is not quite true. We are going to have abstract classes that we are going to instantiate. So you might want to watch and see when we do that. I won't tell you when, just to keep you alert. But we are, in fact, going to be instantiating abstract classes later on. That sounds exciting, doesn't it? You can't wait, can you? All Right, so the point is, I have a class with these abstract methods. I really don't want to instantiate it. So in a sense, what I have now is an abstract class. The abstraction of the methods in some way poisons the class so that I really don't want to have dynamic references of dynamic type, but I can certainly have variables of static type. When you do that, you have to tag your class. When you do that, by that, I mean, oh, this is another thing I figured out. This is another thing I should write down on my card. I should no longer say this or that. I should actually talk about the thing to which I am pointing. But since I'm doing so poorly on the five things I have written on my card, I'm not going to add this other thing I should do. But see, I said thing again. All right. Now I forgot where I was. An abstract class is tagged with abstract. Right. That's the redundancy. If you put abstract methods in your class, then clearly it's abstract. But if you do that, you also have to put an abstract tag on the class itself. Actually, it turns out to be not quite a redundancy. So in the case of dictionary, I would have abstract, void, add, and my other two, and maybe some other ones there. But I would also have to tag the dictionary class itself as being abstract. Now it starts to get all fuzzy because, again, there's this intense pressure to play with code. And that is apparent in the definition of abstract class methods. You can actually define in an abstract class, you can actually define non-abstract methods, which is why it's not quite correct to say that this is a redundancy. Because, in fact, I could tag a class as being abstract and yet have every method in that class be defined or non-abstract. If I remove, in that case, I wouldn't know that the class was abstract. Because all the clues that would tell me it was abstract would be missing. I wouldn't have any abstract methods. In my opinion, having abstract classes that define methods is edging towards the evils of standard inheritance, where you're talking about sharing code. So it's not, and I'll talk, Horstman, of course, sort of hates on the abstract classes, which I don't quite agree with, but a lot of people do. A lot of people recommend not using abstract classes and, in fact, using inheritance. And to a certain extent, they have an argument. We'll talk about it next week. But I think that abstract classes can be a lot more useful than people claim them to be, although, it's easy to abuse them also if you don't use them with care. An abstract class may define implementation methods, right? We talked about that. This is the usual of sharing code with children. And again, the idea of code sharing, you have to be very careful about that. That's where things start to get really muddy when you deal with inheritance in the normal sense. This can be a dangerous design facility, easily abused. On the other hand, it's still an abstract class. Even though you have all the methods instantiated and that argument I gave you previously about, well, if we instantiate an abstract class, what do I do when I call the abstract methods? Of course, if it has no abstract methods, that's not a problem. Even so, because the class itself is tagged with abstract, you can't instantiate it. This actually turns out to be more important in C++ than it is in Java, because in C++ it's a lot less clear what is abstract and what is not. But that's abstract classes. Any questions about that? Pretty straightforward once you understand what the point is and why you might want to use these things. Now we can start talking about the relationship between abstract classes and everything else. Well, we talked about it with respect to instantiation. Now we can talk about it with respect to inheritance, which is the main point of the matter here. A child of an abstract class inherits as normal. So from that point of view, there's no difference. It inherits both the abstract and the defined methods. Again, this is just like C++, where you have the virtual keyword, and the virtual keyword gets dragged down from its parents, too. The abstract method tag is inherited. You have overriding, right? In regular inheritance, you have overriding. Well, you also have overriding when the parent class is abstract, but now you have two kinds of things you can override. You can override a defined method from the parent, or you can override an abstract method from the parent. If you inherit a abstract method from the parent and you don't override it, then the child automatically becomes abstract, and you don't need the abstract keyword here. Oh, I'm sorry, you do. the child must be declared an abstract key, an abstract class too. And then, of course, once you have that child inheriting from the parent, you can also, the child can also add other protocol, other methods also. The child can add other methods, each one of which may be either abstract or defined. If the child inherits abstract methods from the parent and defines them all, then the child is no longer abstract. If you want the child to be abstract, then you'd have to tag it explicitly. If you want the child to be instantiatable, then you would just leave it alone. Now we can start talking about, now that we have these abstract classes and we know how they work, we can start talking about how you would use them. And of course, because you can't, as Jansen just argued, if you can't instantiate them, then the only thing you can do is use them as static types, as declarations for variables. And that's the idea of an abstract class type. So you want to prefer abstract classes as types over non-abstract ancestor classes. This is the point behind defining abstract classes. These would be the things that you would have variables defined as. Abstract class types preserve flexibility and control the complexity. Again, we're using abstraction here, right? We have all these little animals down here, different kinds of cats and dogs, but we abstract away using the mechanism we talked about on Tuesday until we get things like canine and Felix, which covers all the different kinds of cats and dogs you can have. And then we even abstract further than that until we get to, I don't know what's above that. Anybody take biology? Well, at some point, presumably, you hit mammals where you have live-bearing, warm-blooded things, right? So you're controlling complexity, even though you have all these multitude of animals down at the bottom. You're essentially saying, well, you know, they're all mammals. They all respond to the protocol, blood temperature or body temperature, and crying babies or whatever. I don't know. And this is the advantage to using this approach to defining, arranging the type hierarchy in what we'll see as polymorphism. You can implement, essentially what you're doing is you're allowing changes to occur very easily. As long as the instantiation satisfies the protocol defined by the abstract class, you can make that change. Again, that's abstraction. You are focusing on the essential details defined by the protocol. The protocol gives you the essential details, and anything that satisfies those essential details is assumed to be satisfactory for what you need. The trade-off here, on the other hand, there's always trade-offs involved, is you have loss of control. You don't really know what's going on in the individual instantiated classes. You know how they should behave, but you don't know, in fact, whether or not they do behave that way. And some people are uncomfortable with that, but it's something worth getting over. To go back to our typical example, I have a dictionary, which we've defined to be an abstract class. And I have presumably have an ancestor of dictionary, which uses a hash table to provide the expected semantics on the three operations that we've defined. And what's the point there? Oh, I see. I did this backwards for some reason. With respect to this implementation, it's easy to change, with this example, it's easy to change the implementation of a dictionary. Suppose I decide that, well, you know, I don't really need a hash table. I'm only going to have 10 elements. You know, I want to store information on the students in this class, right? There's only 6 students. I don't really need this big hammer of a hash table to do it. I can just change the definition of whatever I assign to D. I can make it be a linked list, for example, or maybe just an array, since it's not only small, but it's also static. On the other hand, if I do something like this, if I embed the actual definition of the dictionary in the static type, I am now stuck. Because if I want to change the implementation, I now have to go around and not only change it here, but also change it in the static type too. That's the loss of flexibility. Now, that doesn't look like a big deal here, right, because everything's in one place. But once you start passing things in through parameter list, once you start having couple hundred thousand line programs or classes, which you probably shouldn't have, it becomes a much more complex matter. You have to make sure that variable and parameter types are rewritten appropriately. You have to find them, first of all, and make sure you're rewriting the right ones. And furthermore, you may, at this point, say, oh, well, D's a hash table. That means I can call something like, what can I call for a hash table for the 306 people? Or, we didn't talk about hash tables in 305, but what kind of thing can I call in a hash table that you wouldn't expect to find in other data structures or other implementations of a dictionary data structure? Load factor is a good example. That doesn't really, well, I suppose you could argue it does make sense in other ones. But we'll just say that, well, as we think of it, load factor doesn't really make sense in an array, for example. This encourages that kind of behavior because, hey, the static type here is hash table dictionary, and one of the methods in that dictionary, in the hash table dictionary protocol, is the load table. Well, let me not say that because it probably, yeah, it'll be public. So one of the methods in that protocol is the load factor, which you're not going to have if this is an array dictionary. Whereas up here, you don't have that. You have the dictionary protocol, add, find, remove. So again, it's this minimalist point of view. You provide minimal amounts of information at the interface that preserves flexibility. But of course, you lose the ability to figure out what the load factor is, if that's important to you. If you're storing lots of information or you have lots of rapidly changing data set sizes. Well, that's why they pay you money. Questions about that? That is our, you can think of it as sort of our introduction to polymorphism. We'll go into this in greater detail when we talk about interfaces on next week, on Tuesday and Thursday. Now we'll take a look at the Java inheritance hierarchy and try and figure out how Java uses this notion of polymorphism in its libraries. And we're going to start by considering, and this will be a significant difference between C++ and Java, we're going to start by considering what's known as the object class. This is capital O. This is one of the reasons I don't like to say object, and when I mean class instance, because now we have an ambiguity. There is a specific class called big O object, and then there's these instances of arbitrary classes called little o objects, and it's hard to hear the difference between capital O object and little o object when I say it, which is why I prefer saying class instance versus object. Now I have to be careful to make sure I do that. The object class is the only class that doesn't have a parent, so it's at the root of the inheritance hierarchy in Java. As a consequence, every class has object as an ancestor. Actually, that isn't necessarily a consequence because I can certainly have, well, no, if it's the only class that doesn't have a parent, it must be the case that every other class has object as an ancestor. Because what I was thinking of is, well, I could have a schism and I could have this little sect of classes over here that has its own pseudo-object, but then that would be something that doesn't have a parent, so that would contradict the fact that object is the only class that doesn't have a parent. Each class has object as an ancestor, and that's either explicitly or implicitly. You can say blob extends object, and that says blob is hanging immediately under object as a child. On the other hand, if you forget to use extends object, like spot, then the assumption is you're talking about extends object. Furthermore, it's transitive. So if drop extends spot and spot extends object, then of course drop is an ancestor of object. Is this picture cut off? No, I guess it isn't. You would anticipate seeing things down here, wouldn't you? I don't know what that's doing there. Huh, I should probably make that look prettier or something, or more useful anyway. This gives rise to the notion of object polymorphism, which is the essential form of polymorphism in Java, which is a real shame. Because every class is an object, object provides a simple form of polymorphism. You can think of anything, regardless of what you have, as an object. I can implement a general stack, in other words, a stack that can store any instance of a class, by essentially treating the elements in the stack, however I choose to implement the stack, as instances of the object class. So the push operation would accept an instance of object. The pop operation will return an instance of object. I guess that should be capital O, shouldn't it? Oh, I guess it is capital O. It looks this way. It's kind of hard to see that it's a capital. All right. This stack can hold any class instance now, as opposed to, for example, creating an int stack where this push would have an integer parameter, and I'm not saying whether that's the primitive integer or the numeric subclass integer. And the return value on pop would be an integer, either one. Because we have autoboxing, it doesn't make any difference. What is the implicit protocol in this polymorphism? Again, the reason this works is because we can treat essentially everything as if it were an object. Something, anything, is an object. So what is that protocol that's going on there?
Well, stack would have all of objects, public methods.
Right. So that's the answer to the question. The protocol is the set of public objects that, the set of public methods that object has, which suddenly incurs a responsibility among the descendants of object. One of the reasons why this approach to polymorphism is a pain is because it requires continual upcasting and downcasting. If you remember from Tuesday, upcasting, as the name suggests, goes from a descendant class up to some ancestor class. And downcasting goes in the opposite direction. It goes from an ancestor class to a descendant class. In the case of push, for example, this is an upcast. I'm going from an instance of blob, which has type blob, and since that is an ancestor of object, I can upcast that to an instance of object. I don't need to do anything specific. It's implicit in the definition of an upcast. On the other hand, once I pop the stack and want to get that value back, I'm going to get a reference to an object, but I want a reference to a blob. That is a downcast. For a downcast, we need an explicit cast, which I have to put in here, and the assignment now type checks. It is this incessant downcasting that makes object polymorphism tedious and dangerous. There should be a period there. The reason it's tedious, of course, is you have to do it. If I take away this downcast, I'll get a compilation error. So that doesn't type check. You're trying to assign an instance of an object. So you're trying to assign a reference which has dynamic type object to something, to a variable which has static type blob. There's no guarantee that that's going to work. So I have to insert the downcast. That's why it's tedious. It's dangerous because it could be wrong. There's no guarantee that what I pop off the stack is, in fact, going to be a blob. It could be anything, right? Because I could push anything in my stack. This is a true general stack. I can push blobs, I can push integers, I can push whatever I want. So that's why it's dangerous. In versions of Java prior to 5, if you look at the code, you'll see it's just littered with downcasts, because that's the only way that you have in Java to define general purpose classes. If you don't want to define integer linked list and double linked list and card linked list, you have to resort to just defining a linked list that deals with object references. And then you adopt the responsibility of upcasting and downcasting. The compiler handles the upcasting because that's easy, right? That's a unique path from the descendant to the ancestor. The problem is there is, as we talked about on Tuesday, there is no unique path down. There are many descendants from a particular class, or potentially many descendants. But there's only one ancestor. And the check for determining whether or not two classes have that relationship is straightforward. This is the reason why object type polymorphism isn't a particularly good approach. But unfortunately, like I said, it's the approach that Java took. I suspect this is just what I talked about, so let's go through it again. Indiscriminate object casting is confusing and dangerous. First of all, you're saying to yourself, well, you know, what kind of stack is this? I can push all kinds of junk. I can push strings and blobs, and I can even push the stack itself on the stack. Wow. One of the problems here, of course, is you now have an almost impossible time trying to figure out what actually is on the stack. So let's suppose I have another function that uses this stack. So it's going to look something like this. I'm going to have the method, and it's going to accept a stack. Oh, wait a minute. What is this saying? This is not... I actually did do this right. It should be this. So the stack accepts an S, and what I want is, and we'll assume that the stack contains an element, so I don't have to worry about stack underflow. That's not my problem here. What I want to do is I want to pop the top element off the stack and store that in a particular variable, and I want to be able to use that variable. I don't want to treat that variable as an object because it doesn't really tell me anything interesting. What I want to be able to do is treat it as something more specific. Problem is, what do I put here and here? Because it could be a string, it could be a blob, or it could be the stack itself.
Object.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. We're driven back to it has to be object. That's the top. I mean, this is the only thing that's guaranteed to work. But now, it's like, I don't want to treat these things as objects. I want to treat them, you know, I want to, if it's a string, I want to append something to it, or if it's a blob, I want to do something else to it. That's the difficulty here. As you might expect, this is a severe problem, particularly as you get to larger and larger systems where people are writing more and more code and you're getting further and further away from the actual uses of stack. And those uses are multiplying, so it may become, even if you could look at a particular use of stack and abstract that pattern into a particular method that uses the stack, you can't guarantee that every use of that stack is going to have the same pattern. So it's really messy. It's a really messy way to go about things. It finally got so bad that the Java people in Java 5 said, all right, we need to do something about this. And what they did was they replaced this notion of object polymorphism. Actually, that's not quite true. But let me just go ahead and read the slide, and I'll come back and fix it. They replaced the notion of object polymorphism with generics. That's what generics is. And actually, what it's doing is it's automating the downcasting in object polymorphism. So to a certain extent, what they did was they didn't replace object polymorphism. They disciplined it. They created a discipline of using object polymorphism. But it didn't go far enough because, in fact, generics can fail, as we'll talk about when we get to generics. And the reason it can fail is because it's a consequence of the fact that you're ultimately doing downcasting on object instances. Prior to Java 5 or 1.5, you only had object polymorphism. So if you look at 1.4 code, you'll see these downcasts all over the place if you're using a general purpose data structure. If you write your own int stack, then you don't have this problem. In addition, if you go to various dark corners of Java, the library, or if you get some code off the web that was written prior to version 5 but not upgraded, then you will also find object polymorphism. Pretty easy to recognize. You have casts all over the place. This is all I'm going to say about generics now. We have another section on that. I don't know when. It's certainly not in 2 weeks. I'm not sure when. Questions about that? And of course, what Sustrup says about this is that the idea of using an Ur class as the basis for all other classes is ridiculous. His way of saying it is, I shouldn't be able to put a battleship in a teacup, which is essentially what this style of programming lets you do. From one point of view, I understand that. You know, it makes sense, putting a battleship in a teacup. You know, you probably want to prevent that. On the other hand, you become too much of a hardy individualist in C++. It's hard to establish connections between things. That's it for object polymorphism. It's pretty straightforward, although the actual mechanism, you have to be extremely disciplined to use it well. I mean, the compiler does give you some help, but unfortunately that help mostly occurs at explosions at runtime, which, in addition to being annoying to the person using your code, are evanescent with respect to you trying to figure out what went on. Object defines several important public methods, which it makes available to all its descendants. Some of these methods include the equals, hash code, toString, and the clone method. There are other ones, but these are the four that we're going to talk about. These are the four that you undertake as someone who creates a class that's a descendant of object. And of course, because you can't do anything else, then you undertake this responsibility every time you create a class. Whenever you do create a class, you should think about overriding these methods. Sometimes you can get away with not overriding them. Other times you can't. You really do need to override them. And there may be other methods associated with object that you want to override, but these are the four that you have to be concerned about. Go and look at the object page on the Java doc and see what all is there. I mean, it's a useful thing to do because these are goodies that you get from the OOR class in the hierarchy. Let's deal with the difficult one first, and that's equality. As always, equality is difficult. When are two class instances equal? What are our possibilities? And you can draw on your vast programming experience because there's at least three definitions of equality, right? So, and of course more if you're a common Lisp programmer. They have, I think, one for every day of the week. When you say two class instances are equal, what are you saying? What's your semantics?
Could be talking about the variables in the class, that every variable in the class is equal to another instance of that variable.
So you're saying that two instances are equal if the corresponding instance variables in the classes are equal. Okay, notice that that's a circular definition, right? Because now we have to figure out what it means for the instance variables to be equal. It's not circular, but you have to ground it.
Well, if let's say you have two employees, they would be equal. In this case, they'd be equal if employee name is equal, employee ID
right.
is equal,
right.
salary,
right.
or whatever other.
Okay. So that's one way to define equality. Any other ways? Exactly. The other way to define it is to say that two instance variables are, I have to be a little careful here now. Two reference values are equal if they are the same address. That's another way. Any other ways to, you might want to say this? Well, that's all we're going to need. Those two definitions are all we're going to need. But any other ways?
You can kind of just define it yourself, depending on.
Yes, that's the other thing. You could say, "Oh, A equals B. That means launch the missiles." That's true.
You could use some sort of hash on each of the objects.
You can define it that way, and that's why, if you notice here, one of the methods that we're going to talk about is hash code. And so there is a relationship there, and you can certainly define equality in terms of hash code, but there are some problems with that, right? I mean, you'd have to extend, that's probably a bad word to use, you would probably have to add to that definition, because just because two instances hash to the same value does not necessarily mean they're equal. They can be, but doesn't necessarily mean they are. Another way to think about it is what's known as observational equivalence. So in other words, two class instances are equal if it is impossible to tell the difference between the two by making a sequence of method calls, making any sequence of method calls on those two instances. That's what's known as observational equivalence. there's other ways of defining equivalence. But the two that we're going to be interested in are what Matt said and what Patricia said. So there are at least two interpretations. Two instances are equal if they are the same instance. This is what's known as identity, as opposed to saying equality. You can say identity. But, of course, the problem there is identity is overloaded, too. So if they are the same instance, they are identical. They are the same thing. What Matthew said is they are similar. They can represent similar values. So you can talk about identity or similarity. The difference between the two of those, well, I mean, there's the obvious difference, but identity involves form and is syntactic, which means it's a very simple test to make, right? You just compare two values, two addresses. If they're equal, you're done. Similarity involves content and, to a certain extent, is semantic. Because, for example, you can have two employees and you can condition equality between those two employees merely on the presence of the same employee ID. So I can forget about the names. And in fact, you probably don't want to use names because I can have two. That would require me to have two people with the same name. I mean, but you can define equality that way if you'd like. That's up to you. Syntactic or similarity is more complicated and involves a wider range of operations, if you will, or things that you have to do in order to determine equality. On the other hand, that means it's perhaps more useful because it admits a larger group of things that can be equal to one another. The useful relationship here is that identity implies similarity. Clearly, if I have two instances that are identical, then they are similar for most useful definitions of similarity. That's not the case in the opposite direction. I have two things that are similar, but they're not identical. Has everyone got that? This is actually going to be important. Any questions about that? This is also should not be surprising. It's not quite as important in C++ as it is in Java, but you have run across it in terms of using, for example, equality of strings. You have to make sure that you're talking about either, presumably what you want to be talking about with respect to strings is similarity as opposed to identity. In Java, you have that problem writ large. Essentially, every instance you have that problem. Here are some examples of that. Equality as identity. I have S1 that is the string fox, and then I have S2 that points to either this instance or that instance. Now the question is, which of those two instances is identical? Right. This one would be the identity. If this held, then this would be the identical form of equality. That would be true. If this holds, then it's not. Equality is similarity. S2 points to some string, and S1 points to some string. And the question here is now, what about the contents of those two strings? So again, this illustrates the differences between identity and similarity. This is just which pointer are you looking at? Right? If you're looking at this pointer, it's true. If you're looking at that pointer, it's false. Down here, well, now we got to start looking at the characters. And if you're looking at these two strings, then we got to do a character by character comparison, or however it is you want to define that. The class designer has the choice between equality as similarity or equality as identity. It's up to you to decide which you'd like to do. What you get from object in form of the equals method is identity. All right? Identity is fast, as we said, but generally speaking, it's usually too strict. So, for example, in this case, I have SB1 and SB2. These are two string buffers which contain the same string, but when I call SB1 equals SB2, I'm going to get false because these are two different pointers. So that is identity up here, but this, in a sense, this reference as opposed to this one. And I don't know, that may be acceptable. It depends on your application. You may decide that that's acceptable behavior or not. Generally speaking, though, you would assume that this is not acceptable behavior. You want something a little bit more permissive. So in this case, whatever you're doing here, you would have to redefine equals in your class, the class that uses this, to provide similarity. Right. Any questions about that? So as a designer of classes, you have the responsibility of trying to figure out what the appropriate definition of equality is. But you have other responsibilities with respect to equality, and this actually turns out to be really important. Wait a minute, did I go too far? Yes. If you go to the documentation, the Java doc for object, and you look in equalities, you'll see that there's a contract there that you have to follow. And this should actually not be a surprise. If you're familiar with the standard template library and the algorithms that accept comparators, things that will return true if one instance is less than another, you'll know that, what's the requirement on those comparators? There's a requirement that you have to fulfill in order for the associated algorithm to work, or in fact, for that matter, container to work correctly. Anybody know that offhand? The comparison has to be a trichotomy. We have a similar requirement on the equality method, and that's a contract. Every equals implementation should, not should, but must satisfy the equality contract. There are other methods that have contracts. The comparable interface has a contract, I believe. We'll talk about that next week. Failure to satisfy the equality contract can lead to really obscure failures. I was dealing with a system at one point where equality was implemented incorrectly on one of the instances that we were using. And when you stored those instances into, you know, like a set, you would lose them because what would happen is you would compare a new instance against an existing instance. Because it's a set, you can only have unique elements, right? So how do you figure out whether an element's unique? You go through all the existing elements of the set, and if you find a element that's equal to the element you're trying to put in, you can throw the new element away because it's already in the set. Well, the problem was, of course, it was returning true incorrectly. So it was incorrectly throwing away the new element, believing, in fact, that the element already existed in the set. When the problem was the implementation of equals was wrong, and you were, in fact, throwing away elements that you shouldn't have thrown away. And it was really obscure because they were doing that to count. So it wasn't the fact that there weren't elements in the set you were looking for. It was the fact that the count was wrong. And then they took that number and they went someplace else and did some other work with that count, and it exploded over there. But the reason it exploded was because they got a bad count over here. It took them about 2 weeks to go from over there, where the boom was occurring, to over here, where the count was wrong. It was quite interesting. Just to give you a real life tales from real life. I actually entered that. I noticed we were working on a compiler at the time, and I was working on one error, one mistake, one bug, and I noticed, oh, you know, there's another bug. So I just put that bug in Bugzilla so that I could, when I finished the bug I was working on, I could go back and take this bug and pick it up again. And what happened was one of my eager beaver colleagues took the bug off the list and said, oh, I'll fix it. And I went to him and I said, you know, you don't have to fix that. I put that on a list so I just remember it and wouldn't forget it. He said, no, I'll fix it. And like 2 weeks later, he finally did fix it. Okay. I was happy he did that. So I guess there are two morals to that story. When you get a bug, put it on a list. Maybe somebody else will pick it up and you won't have to deal with it. But the second thing is, if you don't have anything to do, don't go looking for work. Don't go, you know. Or if you do go looking for work, make sure you understand what it is you're looking at. So make sure that you get the equality contract, which we haven't talked about yet. That's on the next slide. Failure to satisfy the equality contract, right. Inspecting a system's equals implementation is a quick way to estimate development quality. What I learned from that little episode is, well, first of all, we had a large number of incorrectly implemented equalities methods. And for each one, I filed a bug report. But I also discovered, you know, that's a pretty good way to figure out whether or not you're dealing with a quality Java implementation. You just see, first of all, you figure out whether or not they understand that they may have to override the equals method. And if they do override it, take a look at the way they did it and see whether or not it satisfies the contract. If it didn't, then that perhaps may not be a system that you want to deal too much with. All right, so what is this contract? There's essentially five things that you have to do. I shouldn't say things. There are five rules that you have to follow in this contract, or clauses, I guess, when you deal with contracts. Every implementation of equals should be symmetric, reflexive, and transitive. This is no big deal, right? You should have learned this in discrete math. Symmetric means that x is equal to x. That's always true. Reflexive means that if x equals y, then y equals x. And then finally, transitive means if x equals y and y equals z, then x equals z. And so those are the three relational rules that you should follow, or definitions of equality that you should follow. That should be no surprise. The fourth one is it should be null rejecting. X equals null is always false. Nothing is equal to null, not even null itself. Why is that? Why is null not equal to null, or equals null? That's true, but you can say that, well, that's true, but just looking at this, why can't x equals null be true? Well, if it were true, what would that mean? That would mean that x is null too, right? But then that means that we're trying to do a call through the null, which we can't do. This last one's a tricky one. It has to be consistent. If x and y don't change, then x equals y doesn't either. I really don't understand why this is here. And I haven't really been able to get a good answer as to why it's here. My suspicion is it has something to do with cloning and serialization. Essentially what this is saying is if I have an instance of X and I clone it or I serialize it, and then in the case of cloning, I will get a duplicate, but once I serialize it, then I deserialize it or unserialize it and get another copy. So what I'm doing is I'm making copies here. And to a certain extent, those copies shouldn't change. If they're, then clearly the original should be equals to its copy. To the best of my knowledge, that is what this means. But I don't know. I've not actually been able to find any description of why this is here. All right, so these are the five rules that you have to follow when you decide to override the equals method. And as long as you satisfy these rules, then you have an equality. All right. Yes. Yes, this is all with respect to class instances now. The equality that you use on primitive types is the usual definition. Well, actually, it's the definition that JVM gives them. Any questions about this? Make sure you understand this, because you should look at the definitions of equality that you see, or equals, sorry. You should look at the definitions of equals that you see and see whether or not they're good. Right. This is what I meant. You should check and make sure that they obey these five rules. Okay? Here's an example. We have a equals object public Boolean. First thing you do is check for reflexivity. If this is equal to the object you're pointing in, you return true. Right, so that takes care of the first rule. It needs to be null rejecting. Right, so if the instance you pass in is null, then return false. That's the fourth rule. Now we can start to do the rest of them. You check the classes. They should be in the same class. This actually turns out to be a problem, which we're not going to talk about. I don't know that we talk about it here. Maybe we do. Yes, we talk about it next. So we'll come back to this. But for now, They should be in the same class, right? I mean, that makes sense. If they're not, you return false. Why is that questionable?
It could be
an ancestor. Yeah, you could be talking about, you could be looking at ancestors and descendants. And it's not entirely clear that you should do something or anything at that point. Certainly at this point, certainly this is overstating the problem. But we'll leave it. We'll come back to that in a minute. Now we cast it to whatever it is. Apparently this is the equals method in card. We can just cast that to a card, and now we actually do the comparison. If the suits are the same and the ranks are the same, then it's the same card.
Where is the reflexive and transitive?
Here's the reflexive part. Oh, okay. The symmetric part is what you're talking about.
Yeah, symmetric.
The symmetric part is right here, both of these. And then the transitive follows from the transitivity of equality. What can you say about the type of suit and rank? Actually, you can't. Well, they certainly could be primitives, right? But if they're not primitives, then this is a reference equality. So this is essentially identity. They're immutable classes then, because you want to make sure that, actually it's more than that, they're intern immutable classes.
And the next to the equals, that's basically calling this dot sheet and this dot rank, correct? Next to the other side, that's...
Right, this is the suit is, I said this, suit is the instance variable suit in the method, sorry, in the instance on which equals is being called. So I have somewhere in some piece of code, I have this. I have CD equals C. Suit here means CD.suit. And then this is C.suit. That's this one. Another way to think about it is this way, this dot suit. You can always do this. You can always add this dot rank, this dot suit, but that's overdoing it, although I will do that on occasion for documentation. Transitivity comes in from the fact that if C dot, or if C1 is equal to C2, then that means that C1.suit is equal to C2.suit. If C2 is equal to C3, that means that C2.suit is equal to C3.suit. And then by the transitivity of identity, C1.suit is equal to C3.suit, similarly for rank. So that's where transitivity comes from. This is actually kind of involved. I mean, we started off with a really simple idea, and now it's actually, you have to get this right. Some of these things you can fool around with. For example, you can switch these two. You can do the null test first, and then you can do the test for identity second, if you'd like. Can I move this first? Can I make this be the first test?
Wouldn't that throw something if it was null?
Exactly. The problem here is that you don't know that O contains a non-null reference. I could certainly put this one first, and then I could move these two up before this one, but I need to make sure that O is actually dereferenceable before I go ahead and dereference it. We'll come back to your question, I guess, if we have time. Well, I don't know if we will. This is a question you asked after class on Tuesday. All right, let's go back to this rather troublesome point, and this is the point at which you are going to have trouble here. Equality versus inheritance. Again, we've introduced a new feature, so now we've got to figure out what the interaction between this new feature is and all the other old features we know about. Establishing equality among indirectly related classes is tricky, or can be tricky. Generally speaking, it is tricky. The test, the class of the instance that is being called, compared to the class of the instance that is being passed in, can be too strong, in the sense that you may have a relationship a equality relationship between parents and children. What this is saying, what is this saying essentially? What is the semantic, what is the intention behind this test? When I say it's too strong, what is it that's too strong?
The static type of those rather than the dynamic, or is it compared to the dynamic type?
No, it's because these, again, remember we can replace the call to get class with a call to this.get class. This is the dynamic type. Okay. And here we are accessing the reference type contained in O, which is, again, the dynamic type. So we are getting the dynamic types here.
It may be too restrictive because if O.getClass is a descendant, it may not...
Well, let's just go back to the beginning of your sentence. It may be too restrictive. In how? How is it too restrictive?
It may not see a descendant as equal.
Right, because what is the implication of what we see in this test?
That they are of the same class.
Exactly. What this is saying is the only instances that can be equal to one another are instances from the same class. That's the restriction. That's why it's too restrictive. Sometimes that's true. A lot of times that's true. But sometimes it's not. And in fact, what you may have to do is you may have to weaken it to the instance of test. If the instance being passed in is an instance of the class of the instance that's being called, then you can return, actually, that should be, we should have a not here. If it is not an instance of, in other words, if it's not a descendant, then return false. So there should be a bang here. This is a mistake. See if I have an example of that. I should have an example. Let me see if I can cook a quick one up. The typical example is, let's see. Well, the typical example is colored points. How much time do we have? All right, let me just continue on. Does everyone understand what I see an example? Okay, so, all right, so let's go on. And if we have time at the end, I'll go back to it and give an example. But in case we don't have time, I'll make sure we won't have time. What I'm talking about is you have a parent class that's called 2D point, right, and it has x and y values. The definition of equality there should be pretty straightforward, right? It's just if x is equal to x and y is equal to y. Now I introduce a child called colored point. It has x and y that it gets from its parent, but it also has color. Now the question is, if I have an instance of point and an instance of colored point, what's the definition of equals? So I have, let's see, how would we do this? I have P dot equals CP. So I have an instance of colored point as a parameter, and I'm calling equals on an instance of point. This test will fail, right, because a colored point is not the same class as point. On the other hand, a colored point is an instance of point. And it turns out you get into trouble. It's one of these things like, is a square a parent of a rectangle, or is a rectangle a parent of the square? If we have time at the end, we'll come back to that. All right, that's equality. That's essentially the definition of equality. Notice that this definition has nothing to do with whether or not you treat equality as identity or similarity. Either one of those two definitions will match these rules. Okay, so you can define an equals that gives you identity. You can define an equals that gives you similarity. You can define an identity that gives you, sorry, you can define an equals that gives you something else, as long as it obeys these rules. So these rules are not really restrictive enough to give you a unique definition of equals, which is good, because you may not have a universal definition of equality, which is why Common Lisp has 37 different ones. This is actually a really tricky point, but let's just press ahead. Another tricky point is the relationship between hash code and equality. First of all, hash code, as the name suggests, returns an int hash code for O, for for the instance on which it is called. If you go look at object.hashCode, you'll see that it too has a contract. And that contract is, if x equals y, in other words, if you have two instances that are equal by the definition of equalities or by the definition of equals given in a class, then the hash code of x must equal the hash code of y. All right, and this is the essence of hash coding. You have two things that are the same, then they have to hash into the same value. If that's not the case, your hash is broken. Notice this says nothing if x is not equal to y. Overriding equals. If you override equals, then you must override hash code. Remember what happens in the parent. Equals with respect to the object, object.equals, is the identity test. Right? These two references are the same. What is the hash code then in that case? What is object.hashCode? Well, I suppose it could be a lot of things, but what is the simplest thing it could be? Remember, this has to hold.
The hash code should be the same.
Same as what?
Whatever the object that you're calling in front of this.
You're correct, but I don't believe you. Tell me how I do that.
How do you do it?
Yeah. How do I implement hash code in that case?
Say if x equals y.
Hash code doesn't take any parameters. It has no parameters.
So could you just say return this dot hash code?
Inside of hash code, you would say what? What does this do?
Should it be super dot hash? I don't know.
What does this do?
That's in the object?
Yeah, this is object.
Nothing forever.
Right, it just goes into an infinite loop, right? So what did I want here? You're almost right. You went too far. Just return this. Okay. That satisfies this requirement. With respect to object, if this is true, then what do we know? X and Y are the same. Because object implements equals as identity. That being the case, in order to have this be true, with respect to the object implementation of hash code, the only thing I need to do is return this. If we know that this equality holds, then this equality must hold necessarily if we just return the associated instance variables, instance values, sorry. So the implementation in object is really simple. You just return this. On the other hand, if you choose to override equality, you have to make sure that you maintain this contract. It may not be the case that you have to override hash table or a hash code. Although if you end up in a circumstance where you don't, then you probably didn't need to redefine equals in the first place, but Generally speaking, when you override equals, then you have to override hash code. And if you think back to the second week when we talked about tools, and I walked you through, what was it, find bugs. If you remember, the example that I had that I kept getting errors on was the fact that I didn't override equals, and when I overrided equals, then I need to override the hash code. If you remember, you can go back and look if you'd like. So that's a fairly common error. And of course, when I went through the code and looked for all the places where hash code was defined when equals was overridden, of course, I found none. So, Here's an example. Object.hashCode returns the hash code based on the instance address, which is what we just figured out. Object.hashCode doesn't obey the hashCode property with respect to char.equals. Okay, why is that? What fails in card when I call object.hashCode, which, you know, effectively is card.hashCode, but since I haven't overridden that, we go, let's assume, all the way back up to object to find out where hashCode is. Why does it fail?
Because each object has its own instance of that.
Instance of?
Instance of the variable.
Which variable?
Of suit and rank. So.
Yeah, so? Why
so
is that?
If you have, if you do x.suit, it's going to be pointing to a different place than y.suit. We're referring to a different place.
No, x suit and rank are integers, or primitive types, integers, let's say. So that we're not going to have any problem there. But if I don't override hash code, what do I get?
This.
Right. And what's the problem there? Why does that cause trouble? It's not that the hash code has to be unique. It has to satisfy this criteria. So why does it fail?
X and Y are equal, but X and Y are not the same.
Exactly. We can draw a picture. I mean, again, draw a picture. I have card 1, and it has suit 0 and rank 0. And then I have card 2, and that has suit 0 and rank 0. Okay? I've redefined equality or equals. So C1 dot, is this true or false?
That's false.
It's false?
Oh, no, true.
Well, we have one claim for true, one claim for false. Which one's right? Right, we overwrote the equals. So let's just go through it. This is not equal to the parameter, so we're not going to do anything there. The parameter is not null. We're not going to do anything there. The class of the instance being called is equal to the class of the parameter's instance. They're both cards, so we're not going to do anything there. We're going to downcast the object that we passed in, the object instance, to a card, right? And now we're going to compare the suits of the instance that we're calling with the suits of the instance that we're passing in. So we're going to say c1.suit equal to c2.suit, true or false? True. c1.rank equal to c2.rank, true or false? True. Right. So we're going to return true. This is equal to true. All right? Now, what happens when I call c1.hashCode? What do I get? No. I get the address of C1. Why?
Because you didn't override the hashCode.
Exactly. I didn't override hashCode, so I do c1.hashCode. Where is hashCode? Certainly it isn't defined in card, so I go grubbling up the stack, up the hierarchy, and I find it in object. We already argued that object has implemented hash code as return this. So c1.hashCode is essentially going to return C1, the address of, if I can use this disgusting C++ notation, c1.hashCode is going to return the address of C1, or the reference to C1. What is c2.hashCode going to return? Right, reference to C2. C1 equal to C2 as references? No, right here. So this is false. I'm sorry. This is false. X.hashCode or C1.hashCode is not equal to C2.hashCode. So that fails. I overrid equals in card, but I did not override hash table. Sorry. hash code. So what do we have to do? Well, it's up to you. You can do pretty much whatever you want. In this case, I just said, well, return rank plus suit. All right? And I'll leave it up to you to determine that this, in fact, satisfies this contract. Oh, I should point out while I'm here, contracts are a way of ensuring that you get semantic relationships between parents and children. Remember I said the great lie in object-oriented programming is the fact that you establish a syntactic relationship between parents and children, and you hope that you have a corresponding semantic relationship there. Contracts are an example of attempting to do that. But again, contracts are just words on a documentation page. You can ignore them as you want. You can not even know they're there. So it's kind of a weak form of enforcing this. But it tells you what you need to do. Okay. So let's see. ToString, this is for your own benefit. You don't have to do this, but it's usually considered to be a good thing to do. The instance method ToString returns a printable representation of this. Right. Generally speaking, you should always override ToString so that you have some printable representation for your instances. So for example, I can say employee ToString. If I just go back to the parent, or sorry, if I just go back to object and call ToString there, I get something like class name at address. Not very helpful. On the other hand, if I override ToString in the employee class, then I can say something like, well, you know, it's the name of the person, or maybe the employee number or something. Just, you know, make it look nice. Oh, and that's it, summary. Polymorphism is your exploitable friend. Unfortunately, again, remember I said that inheritance is a very powerful tool to implement what we've talked about as protocol satisfaction. And here's another example of that. We are over-engineering the need to implement polymorphism. We'll ameliorate that somewhat when we get to interfaces next week. Abstract classes are one way of defining protocol classes, a way that makes your intention clear and also reduces the amount of work you have to do in the definition. Object class provides a weak form of polymorphism. And, in fact, it provides the only form of polymorphism in... Do I want to say that? Well, there are other forms. Let me say this then. It provides the major form of polymorphism in Java. That's going to be true even when we consider generics. It also adds several subclass responsibilities. You have to override, or at least consider overriding, those four methods, equals, hash code, ToString, and clone. And then for equals, you have to figure out what the appropriate definition of equality is, and whatever you decide, then you have to redefine hash code. That's it. Any questions? Seeing no questions, we're done. Have a good weekend.